This is Debbie Goldman, and with Jeff Reckenbach, we are interviewing Linda Foley, and it is January 4th, 2024. We're in Linda's home in Potomac, Maryland. Linda, let's start a little bit with your personal life. Where did you grow up? And tell us a little bit about the community that you grew up in.
Okay, so I grew up outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in a suburb there. And I would say it was an upper middle class suburb. Did not have much union background in my family, but I was from in the Pittsburgh area. So unions were very prominent in the Pittsburgh area. So union was never like a bad word for me. It was always sort of part of the, you know, course of doing business or being in the workplace. So when I graduated from high school, well, first, when I was in high school, in my junior year, I was very interested in writing and was active in like the school newspaper and the school yearbook. But I also got an opportunity to study in a 5-week course for high school rising, now they call rising seniors, at Northwestern University in the summer. And so I took advantage of that. It was a very defining moment in my career because it really solidified for me that I wanted to be a journalist and that, that, you know, reporting on things, could change, you know, could make change. And I found it very empowering. So I did that. And then, of course, I applied to Northwestern University, Medill School of Journalism, got in because I had been in the summer program partly, and spent 4 years there. So then when I graduated from Northwestern, I got a job pretty quickly at a time when journalism jobs weren't that plentiful. I got a job pretty quickly at the Lexington, Kentucky Herald Leader. And so I went to Lexington, Kentucky, loaded up my car, which was a Pacer at the time, and I put all my plants and everything in my car and drove to Lexington, Kentucky, where I, you know, had, it was, in all my wildest dreams, I never thought I'd end up in Lexington, Kentucky. But Lexington is kind of a neat town. It's a university town. And the paper was a good newspaper. And so I started off on a paid internship there and then migrated eventually to a full-time job, where I was a copy editor, and then I also did some reporting as well. So I did that, and that's where I got involved in the union.
Terrific. We'll get to that in just a second. What town were you, what suburb were you in?
The suburb was called O'Hara Township, and even people from Pittsburgh don't even know what that is sometimes. So O'Hara Township is on the north hills of Pittsburgh. I attended Fox Chapel High School, which is a pretty tony high school in Pittsburgh.
Public high school?
It's a public high school, yes.
And if you don't mind me asking, what year were you born?
I was born in 1955.
And your parents, what did they do?
Well, my dad was a doctor. He was a family doctor, had a really great reputation in the community, very well known. My mother was, she, when we were younger, was a stay-at-home mom, but she was also a really good writer. So she got involved in, later in life and also early in teaching writing to adults, like she taught poetry and stuff like that. And then she also did have a teaching certificate, and she was fluent in several languages, including French and Italian. So she went and worked as an Italian teacher and then as a French teacher. Yeah, I know. She was pretty amazing. But I think my mother would say that she was, if you said, what was your occupation? I think she would say I was a mother because she was very much all about her kids.
How many siblings?
I have 3 siblings. I'm the oldest. So I have 2 brothers that follow behind me. And then I have a sister who's at the end.
And what would you say from your upbringing was core to development of your values and your commitments?
Certainly my parents were very, they were pretty adamant about their views, their moral views. My dad was pretty conservative politically, although he drifted to the left as he got older, interestingly enough. My mother was always, I think she influenced me the most because she was always a person who said, you know, you can do whatever you want. Don't listen to them, right? You can do whatever you want. You can. And one little story, it's a political story, but my grandmother, so my mother grew up in a very Catholic family, Italian Catholics. And my grandmother, who was, you know, from the pre-World War II generation, they were Republicans. And so during the 1960 election, I love this story. During the 1960 election, they kept saying to her, Adele, now you know you're going to vote for Nixon, right? You're going to vote for Nixon. Well, she liked John Kennedy because he was a Catholic. And she kept saying, yes, yes. And then she told me later, she said, when I got in that voting booth, I did what I wanted. So I was like, cool. And she was not a rebel, but my mom was pretty, you know, she was pretty forceful about, you know, being treated equally. And I don't think she would have called herself a feminist, but I think she kind of was. I mean, she just taught us that we could be whatever we wanted, my sister and I, you know, so that was cool.
And was your father Republican?
He was for a long time. In fact, he ran for local office as a Republican at one point, lost for the little township council. He lost, but as I got more involved in CWA and then after in 2008, I went to Pittsburgh and worked with Marge Krueger and some other people in the AFL-CIO.
Marge Krueger was CWA staff rep.
Yes.
In Pittsburgh.
Right. So I worked with Marge Krueger and some other people in the labor movement in Pittsburgh, including Leo Girard, who was national president of the steelworkers. Worked on the Obama campaign because it was very exciting, and I had just left CWA. So, and my dad, you know, came to me at some point and said, Linda, how do I change my registration? So then he not only like moved, he was already moving left. He not only moved to the left, he actually changed his registration because he got really mad at the Republicans and the way they were treating Obama. I was sort of shocked by that, but I'm not sure he stayed true to that the rest of his life, but I'll take credit for it.
Were you raised a Catholic?
I was, yeah.
You went to church and
I went to church. I never went to Catholic school.
Was that? You never went to Catholic school, but was being a Catholic also formative in your forming your values?
Probably. My mother's family was very religious. My mother in the beginning was, because that's the way she was raised. So when she was a young mother, she was pretty religious. My dad never cared that much for it. I mean, he would go, but he wasn't all about it. She was, but then she started getting less and less and less. And, so I don't know that I could point to the Catholic Church and say, you know, those were my values. I mean, my memories of the Catholic Church are like sitting in the pew and making fun of the choir director's hat. You know, I mean, I don't have like these great moral stories. I do. It was influential in that the Monsignor who was at our church and was very conservative, and this was, you know, in the early 70s, and so, you know, there was a lot going on with women's rights and reproductive rights, and when we would ask about it, we would just get shut down, and I think that did influence me, because I was like, okay, I'm not dealing with this. These people are just wrong. I am not going to, you know, participate with them, and I'm moving on. So I think my family influenced my values more than my participation in the church.
Where did the restaurant come in?
Oh, the restaurant was my mother. Well, my mother came from a restaurant family, which they're all gone now, I think. But, well, one guy is still alive. But my grandmother was the oldest of 10 children, some of whom were born in Pittsburgh, and including my grandmother, and some of whom were born in Italy. And her brothers owned various restaurants in Pittsburgh, all by the name of Tambellini, that had a tremendous reputation in Pittsburgh because they had good food. And Jeff asked because we went there.
Well, and they were famous in Pittsburgh.
They were very famous, yeah. So we went there. That's closed now. Yeah, but they're almost all of them are just about closed. I mean, there are a couple of Tambellini restaurants, but they're like distant relatives. So, but that was always something that my grandmother would always say, don't tell them about Tambellini. when we go to another restaurant, don't tell Mama Tambellini, don't tell Mama Tambellini. I don't want to. And of course, my dad would say, you know, she's a Tambellini. And they'd say, But anyway, that was quite fun.
How do you spell Tambellini?
T-A-M-B-E-L-L-I-N-I.
I never would have guessed
and
that.
And it means little warlike people.
Really?
That's what my mother told me. It means little warlike people.
I think that's a good name for the family, for the person I know.
Yeah.
And on your father's side, was there any ethnic?
Oh, yeah. So my father's mother goes all the way back. Her father's family goes all the way back to the founding of Boston. But her mother was emigrated from Ireland before my grandmother was born. She and I think there were three sisters. I didn't know them at all. So I knew my grandmother. I didn't know her mother. They came from Ireland and settled in Boston. And then my dad's father, I could spend the whole interview about my dad's father. He was so interesting. He was from Czechoslovakia. And he was he had a PhD in petrochemistry. This was in around 1918, 1920, when the industry was just taking off. So he was in real demand, but there was a war. So his stories of trying to get to America are pretty amazing because like he was on a boat that got blown up in Athens Harbor. And then because he lost his passport. And because he had a thick accent, they thought he was a German. The British captured them as they tried to go through the Straits of Gibraltar, threw him in jail. But he would say, you know, that the British, he would say that they treated them like they were at a country club. They gave him cigarette rations and beer, and, you know. And the only thing was that every day they'd march him through the streets of Gibraltar and people would yell at him. But other than that, it was fine. So we spent the whole war there. And then when it was finished, they were like, oh, Mr. Kinsel, we made a mistake. So they gave him essentially reparations. I mean, it wasn't a lot of money, but it was enough money for him to get then to the United States. He had had a job waiting for him, I think in Boston, but it fell through, and then he got another one. He had no trouble finding work. And at one point, even owned a refinery in Nashville. So my dad was born in Nashville because he owned a refinery, but he was a lot older than my grandmother. He was, when he got married, he was like 42 or 43. So he was a lot older. My grandmother was like 20. So he's like twice her age.
Interesting family. Yeah,
it was very interesting. He was a very, very interesting guy. Spoke with a very thick accent. A very interesting. I'll digress for 1 second. But recently I got, because of Facebook, right? I got a note from a guy named George. So my last name was Kinsel, K-I-N-S-E-L. K-I-N-S-E-L. And, but really in Czecho, it was spelled K-I-N-C-L. And so I got this message from this guy named George, K-I-N-C-L. And he said, because my parents passed away and he saw it on Facebook. He must have been following me. He lives over by Baltimore.
Oh.
And he is, I think he's my second cousin. He's my grandfather. His grandfather and my grandfather were brothers. So,
wow.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's older than I am, but... Not by much. Yeah. I mean, but he's older than I am.
I should have asked him. Then your pre-married name was
Kinsel, K-I-N-S-E-L.
And you took Foley when you got married.
Yeah.
One last question about your upbringing and background that maybe will jump us ahead as
okay.
well. Your generation, and I put myself,
yeah.
our generation,
yeah.
it was a complex transition time for women. You became quite a leader, quite an independent woman. How do you recall the kinds of messages and education, I guess, that led you to being such a leader as a woman and an independent woman?
Well, first when I joined my local in Lexington, Kentucky, it was very small. And actually my husband, who wasn't my husband at the time, said, you should come to the union meeting. Okay. So I left out that I had been a member of the paper workers union in high school because I worked in a, I worked in a Christmas wrap factory. I did. And it was the middle of July and we were doing like packaging these little snowmen and all this stuff. And there was no air conditioning. It was really, infuriating. But anyway, they had a union there. And the union, because I was a kid, The union steward really, and there was a guy that was kind of creepy that was trying to hit on me, and the union steward really protected me. Like, he stood up for me. And I went to the women there and I said, this guy is really coming after me. And they said, oh, you need to go to Bill, the union steward. So I went to Bill, little guy, and he goes, we got it. So when I left the plant then that night, he had the tallest, biggest guys from the union escort me out. And when the guy tried to stop me, the guy that had been harassing me, they surrounded him and started screaming at him. I thought they were going to beat him up. And they started screaming at him, and he never bothered me again. I was like, oh, this union stuff, this is pretty good, right? So when my husband said, you know, you should come to the union meeting, I said, okay. He said, it's a good way to meet people. So I met four people. And they had officer elections. And I got elected, I think treasurer.
What local?
It was at the time it was local 229 Lexington Newspaper Guild. And I got elected treasurer. So there wasn't a lot of money, so it was okay. And then I went to the we had a rep come in and help bargain our contract, and he said, you know, you guys should really come to the convention, the union convention that we have. And we had it every year at that point, like CWA.
We meaning?
Guild.
Right then it was called the Newspaper Guild,
it was called,
right?
The Newspaper Guild, yeah. And so I said, Monty and I said, sure, we'll go. And
Monty is?
My husband. I'm sorry, my husband is
Was
Monty.
He also a journalist?
Yes. He started as a journalist, and he also was a good union member. So before I was. So we went to the convention, and I was young at that point. I had graduated from high school. I'm sorry, college. I think the year before, or maybe a year and a half, I was only out of college. So I was about 24 years old, 23, 24 years old. And, you know, I was getting up on the floor and talking about things. And so they really liked me, you know, like they said, oh, we got one, right? We really like this person. So the president of the guild at that point was a guy named Chuck Perlick.
How do you spell Perlick?
P-E-R-L-I-K. And he took me under his wing kind of politically and had me chair his reelection campaign. Yeah, it was pretty wild. So we were getting ready to leave the convention. I got a call, you know, from, and Monty said, it's Chuck. And the secretary treasurer was Chuck Dale. Mm-hmm. So there was Chuck Perlick and Chuck Dale. I said, Chuck, which one? He said, Perlick. I said, Perlick or Dale? He said, Perlick. I said, oh, this was like, so he asked me if I would chair his election committee. And I said, sure. So that's kind of how I got my start. And they liked me because I was supportive of the, you know, union's positions. I wasn't a shit stirrer, so to speak, right? And I was supportive of their positions. And I think they thought we had done a pretty good job in Lexington, given the limited resources we had. So they liked me. And that's kind of how I got started in the union.
And tell us a little bit about your trajectory in the union.
Okay, so I was president of the small local. But I was very well known because of my role. And annual conventions helped that. So this is my opinion, but, you know, we moved away from annual conventions in the CWA. And one of the things annual conventions do, I understand why, and I'm not, it's costly. Okay, and you know, and it can lead to mischief, but what it does do is it does give people kind of, in the guild, it was kind of a leadership development program. So every year I could go back and build on what, you know, the network and the credibility I already had. And when I look back on it, and I think, you know, I think that was a part of what made me rise to the top of the union. So I did that. I was president, and I went to, pretty much just to the conventions, and that was about it. That went on for a couple of years, maybe 3 years. And then there was a job opening in the collective bargaining department as a researcher. And they were not treating me very well at the paper because I was a rabble-rouser. And they were, you know, my career there was not on any kind of trajectory. And I liked the union stuff, you know, so... When the job opened up, there was a man who was head of the contracts department. His name was Dick Ramsey. And they called him executive secretary of the contracts committee. That's a weird guild thing, but he was basically director of collective bargaining. And so he liked me because he had come in and bargained our contract and stayed at my house. And so he liked us. So he hired me, and I was in the research. There were two researchers. One was myself, and the other one was Eric Geist, who eventually came to CWA. And so we became real. We knew each other from conventions and district council meetings, but we became really good friends and, you know, sort of helped each other out. And then Ramsey's boss, who was the field operations director, who was more or less, I think, in CWA, he would be like an executive assistant to the president, basically. His name was Bill Blatz. He was ancient, and he, colorful, but ancient. And he retired, and so they were looking for a replacement for Blatz. And Ramsey was in the running, but he didn't get it. So he left. And that left an opening. And the guy that did get it was a guy by the name of Bill McLeman. I don't know if you know that guy. Bill McLeman. He retired shortly after we merged with CWA. He was by far and away the best mentor I ever had in the union movement. This guy, he was from Canada.
How do you spell McLeman?
McLeman. And he had been the Canadian director, and then he got this job as the field operations director. And when Ramsey left, he called me in and he said, I want you to apply for Ramsey's job. He said, there's nobody better in the union than you to hold this job. And I was pretty young. I'm not even sure I was 30 years old at that point. Maybe I was close. Yeah, but at most I was in my early 30s. So I was young. And this was, there were all these like old, wise old men there, right? and I was like, and then what he proceeded to do, so I ran the collective bargaining department then and helped locals handle grievances as well as bargaining and I still to this day think that was one of the best jobs I ever had. And I really enjoyed doing it. And McLeman, the reason he was such a good mentor was this was a guy who probably had, not probably, he did. He had like 25 years of union, professional union experience. And he was my boss. And when there were big decisions to be made, he would call me in and ask me what I thought and whether I had any ideas about how to tackle a problem. For a young woman in that position, that was so important because it really boosted my confidence. And I thought, well, geez, if Bill McLeman thinks I can do this, then, yeah, I must know what I'm talking about, right? So he was really, really good. He just passed away last year, and it was very sad. He also was a really nice guy, really nice guy.
And you were in Washington area?
Yeah, we were in Washington, D.C. I moved here when I got the job.
The first job?
The first job as a research assistant.
And you were in Silver Spring then or no?
No, we started, we actually had an office in the IBEW building across from the Washington Post on 16th Street. I haven't talked about this stuff in a long time. So during that time, this is when I was a researcher, not head of the collective bargaining department. There had been ongoing talks with the what was called the ITU, the International Typographical Union, which ended up being the print sector in CWA, right? The guild had had ongoing talks with them for years. Finally got to the point where we had a merger agreement hammered out. And we were going to merge with the ITU, which made all kinds of sense, right? Because they were in the back shop, we were in the front shop. The ITU was having a lot of problems. We were not, in terms of jurisdiction. I mean, we had money problems, but we didn't, because we were small, but we didn't have problems in terms of the work. They did. They were losing the work. So we hammered out this merger agreement. We had this big, it was the Guild's 50th anniversary, and we voted on this merger agreement at the convention, and everybody was singing Kumbaya and holding hands, and oh, we can't wait to be in the, I forget, we had a name for it. I can't remember what it was. And the president of ITU was a guy named Joe Bingle. He was, I'll say it, even though he's long gone, he was a snake. And so he went, they then were supposed to vote on it at their convention. And instead, he invites Jackie Presser from the Teamsters to come to their convention. And Presser, on the floor of their convention, invites them to merge with the Teamsters. So then it was like newspaper guild who, right? They like ripped up the merger agreement, and they were going to merge with the Teamsters. And I don't know if you know this part, but Bill Borman, who was a vice president of CWA for the print sector when I was there, Borman was a young guy. He was also a vice president of the ITU during that time. Borman did not want to merge with the Teamsters. And so they were looking around for other merger partners. And the AFL-CIO, remember the Teamsters, you know, Presser, there was all this like corruption around the Teamsters and stuff. And the Teamsters were not in the AFL-CIO. Here's the world's oldest union, right?
The ITU.
The ITU. And Lane Kirkland was beside himself that Lane Kirkland, being the president, national president of the AFL-CIO, was beside himself that the ITU was going to go with the Teamsters. My understanding is he went to Morty Barr, president of CWA, and said, can you take these guys? I think that's what happened. I mean, but Borman, Bill Borman was key to that because he was not unknown. He had a following. So he rallied support for CWA. So then, you know, the ITU moved into CWA. And the guild, we were like, okay, what do we do now? We can't continue on our own. What do we do now?
Why couldn't you continue?
Because we didn't have enough money. We didn't have enough resources. And the newspaper industry at that point in time was starting its war against its workers. And we were having strikes all over the country, major strikes. Our strike fund was being depleted. We really had a lot of problems. So,
and why did the newspapers go at war with the unions in that period?
Well, my theory is that they, they used to be a pretty benign industry before, you know, when the mergers of media outlets started to happen, that's when they started to go to war because they needed to trim the workforces, right? And you combine that with a technological revolution in the news industry, which occurred about the time I got in, actually. And it was just enormous pressure on them to downsize. And so in order to do that, the unions were too strong, and particularly the craft unions. So it wasn't so much a war on the guild as it was a war on the craft unions like the ITU, the International Typographical Union, and the GCIU, who were the pressmen, and the mailers, who stuffed the papers. So these were all different unions in the newspapers, and they all paid really, I mean, they had good contracts. And so if you're looking at consolidating and merging, that's not a, you know, that's not something you want. So.
And the technological revolution was going from the lead type,
hot type to cold type,
which was
in the beginning. Digital? Well, in the beginning, cold type was we would input on electric typewriters, and they would be scanned into a computer, and then the type would be printed out on like this. Certain glossy grade of paper, and they would paste them up on, they would have flats where they had the layouts of the pages, and they would paste them actually on the pages rather than sit at a linotype machine and type it. And what that did was anybody could do that, right? But the ITU used to be very skilled work. You had to go through an apprenticeship program. You had to be really trained to be able to do those linotype machines. It was really skilled work, and that went by the boards. So, Morty Barr wrote about this in his book quite extensively, what happened. And that's how they got the lifetime job guarantee. So I'm not going to go into any of that. But anyway, that's what was going on. And then the consolidation, where they were trying to consolidate operations, and they had, you know, these bigger and bigger corporations were taking over. And then eventually it got to the place where the companies that owned them weren't even in the news business anymore, you know. And it just became so that's that. So we were under a lot of pressure. So when you're under
a lot of pressure, we're talking early '80s, mid '80s.
Yes, early '80s. Yeah, we were under a lot of pressure in the guild, and because we didn't have a merger, because we thought we had a merger agreement and we didn't. So what do you do when you don't have a merger agreement? You buy a building. So we bought a building, and that's how we got to Silver Spring. They bought a building in Silver Spring. A little controversial because last thing we really needed was a building. And then once we bought the building, there was poor financial management. But in addition to that, the building became a money suck. And as it was being built and, you know, as we were transitioning in. I mean, we could have moved into an existing building, but no, we had to build a building. So, and I think, well, I think that people felt that that was something to, like, secure the Guild yeah. to eternity, right? Okay, so there's the Guild building, right? So that's how we got to Silver Spring.
And you had about how many members at that point?
Oh, our membership didn't change that much in my tenure in the Guild. We had between 32 and 34,000 members. At one point, we hit 36, but that was after we merged with CWA, and then it started going down again. So.
And did you bargain contracts in Lexington?
Did I?
Yes.
Yes, with the help of the International, yes.
And then you, when you were the director of collective bargaining, what was what was that department's role?
So, everything with the Guild is complicated.
I know it's different than other unions.
Very complicated. So, the Guild did not have, like, we didn't bargain single contracts for these big employers. So, you would, let's take Hearst for an example. So, Hearst was a newspaper chain that was very prominent in the Guild's heyday. We did not have a single contract covering all of the Hearst newspapers. Part of that was the NLRB and the NLRA and the way they divided up bargain units. And the other part of it, let's face it, was turf, right? So so we didn't have, you know, that kind of bargaining. We did do some joint bargaining with the other unions, mixed bag on the success of that. But instead of that, we had a program called we had what we called our collective bargaining program. And we had as a part of that, a model contract. So we tried to get contract language in all of our contracts that mirrored what was in the model. The problem with it is the model contract was subject to convention approval. So every year, people would get up. I used to call it the Christmas tree. Every year they'd get up and they'd say, okay, now we want paid family leave for a year. And we're going to put that in the contract, in the model contract. And it's just a goal. Yeah, but they don't take you seriously if you put that on the table. So we had that, and the locals had to submit their contract proposals to us, and we technically had to approve the contract proposals. And that was a lot of what I did, was I looked at the contract proposals and I said, okay, does this conform to the bargaining program? And then, you know, they were supposed to make it conform in areas that it didn't always happen that way. They always also didn't always submit them. And so that was part of what I did. And then the other part of what I did this more when I was a researcher, and I always thought it was really dumb. So when I became director of collective bargaining, I got rid of it. But they then used to analyze the contracts after they were bargained and say, This doesn't meet it. I mean, people are doing the best they can. What are you talking about? This is before I came, but the Guild lost a unit at the Arizona Republic, which back in the 70s, it was a tough organizing drive. Dick Pattison, one of the union reps, one of the Guild reps, it was so bad. They were so vicious. He got locked in a trunk of his car in the desert. You know, and he had told somebody where he was going. So they like went looking for him, and that's the only way he survived. I mean, it was a bad, and we won. And so they started to bargain a contract, and the powers that be, not me, this is before me, the powers that be in the collective bargaining department decided that the sick leave provision in that contract wasn't good enough. So they rejected it. And, you know, this was a multi-year battle, and the members said, okay, bye. We're done here. We did the best we could. We're out of here. It was a terrible story. So, but we had stories like that. That's the worst example. So we were struggling, but we had a good reputation. You know, so.
So talk about the decision to reach out to CWA and that process and the controversies about it then and now.
Right. So Chuck Dale, who had been secretary treasurer, became president of the newspaper guild. And Bill McLeman was a part of this. And then we had a guy who was secretary treasurer named John Edgington. I don't even want to go into that. But I was not secretary. Was my secretary treasurer? Let me think. Yes, I was, actually. Then I, because of John Edgington, I got elected secretary treasurer because he was so bad. But anyway, he's passed away, too. So
and
I
that was what year?
1993. So Chuck Dale was always a big proponent of us merging. And there was a lot of, you know, the Guild members. The Guild wasn't, even at that time, when the Guild first started, it was primarily reporters and editors, right? But as the Guild grew, that they weren't the majority of people in the union. Because there were a lot of people working in the classified department and in the circulation department. They were all part of the Guild. And so the editorial part of it was slightly less than 50%, you know, not unlike what happened with the Bell people in CWA, because we were bringing in, you know, more jobs, right? And so, they always controlled the union, because they were, you know, a lot of them would get up at the mic and they were very articulate, you know, and when, you know, when you get these people who are Pulitzer Prize winning reporters or work at the New York Times or the Washington Post and they get up and make their points, people listen, right? So they were driving the, so they had this identity that they, you know, wanted to maintain. And that they were scared about a merger because they said, oh, our identity will go away. And, you know, we need to have our own union because we're so special. No, we need to have our own union because we do this unique job. And, you know, we have to be objective and we have to, you know, what we do is really important. And, you know, I mean, I could go down the, tick down the list. Right?
And we're professionals.
And we're professionals, yes.
And so, also, was it linked with, because we are journalists, we need to be nonpartisan?
Yes,
and
yes, very
objective.
Much so. Yeah.
I mean, unions take political.
The Guild over the years flirted with getting rid of that and got slammed. The leaders got slammed every time. Every time. Yeah, that was a lot of it. But it wasn't all of it. You know, the other part of it was, well, you know, we need to have our own identity. I mean, we're not printers, you know, we're not Teamsters. So Chuck Dale was very much a proponent of merge. Well, back up. We did a strategic plan, which we hired two people to help us with a strategic plan. And remember, we had just the merger with ITU had fallen through. And one of the recommendations from the people that did the strategic plan, I think Chuck Dale probably influenced it, but they said, you know, you really need to pursue a merger. You need to do these other things, mobilization and organizing and na-na-na-na-na-na, but you also need to merge with another union because you won't have the resources. I think that was accurate, actually. I think that was a good assessment. But we had a merger committee that was a small committee. It was a small group. It was myself. I was at that point secretary treasurer, Chuck Dale, Bill McLeman. It was the three of us. And we would go, and it was great because we got a lot of great food. Like, except at CWA. I always said CWA food was the worst. But the best was GCIU, by the way. Because
DCIU?
GCIU. Graphic Communications International Union, the Pressmen. Because they really wanted us. Teamsters was okay, but they had their own cafeteria. But the GCIU, Jim Norton, the president, he would order out at this fancy Italian restaurant. And Bill McLeman would say to me, I wonder what we're having to lunch today at the GCIU. He said, if we were merging kitchens, this would be a no-brainer. So anyway, and we would joke about that. Yeah, the food is, you know, we get a lot of good lunches except at CWA where we get like little sandwiches, you know, like ham sandwiches or something. Yeah, box lunch or something, right. So, but anyway, but the problem was that there was no way that the Guild could merge with the Teamsters. That just would not have worked at all because of the corruption, the reputation of the Teamsters, that would not have passed. And really, there was only really one choice, and that was of the three we were looking at. And we didn't look at, like, I think a couple of other unions, like the Machinists came to us, and maybe we had one meeting with them. But we were interested in merging with someone who had a connection to our industry, right? So there really wasn't any other. The GCIU was a possibility, but they were having their own problems. And we never meshed with them culturally at all. Whereas with CWA, you know, a number of us were, well, Eric Geist and I were very active in Jobs with Justice. We got to know CWA that way. You know, we had worked with CWA on some other projects. We had members in the CWA. The research department of the CWA used to be members of the Guild. Yep. So we had a lot of connections to CWA. And we used to say, among the three of us, you know, well, CWA is a clean union. You know, we since found out that there were some people that weren't so clean. But but overall, CWA was a clean union. I mean, not like the Teamsters, right? And even the GCIU had some sketchiness, right? So so that was attractive to us. And that really ended up being the only choice. And then when Morty Barr and Barbara Eichling was involved too, but it was mainly Morty that was driving it. Morty Barr and Emmy Nichols was involved, but he didn't offer much, really.
He was EVP at that point.
He was EVP, and then Larry Cohen, who was director of organizing. And Larry really saw a good possibility for us in CWA. And I personally knew Larry. We all knew Larry because we had been active in Jobs with Justice. We were one of the first unions to be active in Jobs with Justice when he first was putting that together. So we knew Larry, liked him. Dale liked Morty. We all liked Morty. It's not hard enough to like Morty, but you know, Larry was the guy we knew. And, so Larry really tried to push that to make that happen. And so I would have a lot of side conversations with Larry about this identity issue and how important it was to make sure that people had their identity. That was the other thing about CWA. That was said from the get-go. You can have your own sector or organization within the CWA, and you can, you know, do your own thing, right? That was very attractive because that was not going to happen in any of these other unions we were talking to. So that was very important, this whole identity issue driving that. So that's, you know, really how it came about, and we pushed it, and then, it actually, when we put it up for a vote, I was also running for president, but when we put it up for a vote, it actually passed overwhelmingly. I was a little surprised. I mean, there was a little bit of pushback, but not much.
Because people understood you needed to be with the union that had more resources.
And everybody, you know, all the people that were, that they looked up to, and I'll throw myself into that bucket, right? Because I started as, you know, sort of the new blood, right, coming in. And so I was in favor of it. And I was a journalist, and I always felt like I spoke for the journalists a lot of times. And so they looked at me. And we did a job selling it. I mean, we went around the country and really sold it. And in Canada, the one issue we had a lot of problems with was Canada, because Morty had decided he was going to let CEP go, right?
So CEP was?
Communications, Energy, and I forget what the P stands for. I don't remember. Printing. Communications, yeah. Energy, and Printer Union, which used to be, grew out of the ITU in Canada, but mm-hmm. but grew much larger, and they were... We were having a lot of problems in the Guild in Canada. We had locals leave us and go to Canadian unions. There was a whole movement to move toward Canadian-only unions in Canada because they felt, starting with the auto workers, because they felt like they were being taken for granted, which they were. And so there was a whole, like, nationalistic movement, and the Guild got caught up in that. And so then the CEP factor was a tricky question. So we ended up actually doing a separate agreement about Canada. I mean, it was part of it, but it was separate, and only the Canadians voted on it. And but we said to them, you're going to have your own autonomy, because they were, we need Canadian autonomy. We need to make our own decisions and not have to go through Washington in the Guild. And so we set up this, you know, Canadian autonomy agreement as part of the merger agreement, have their own governing board, and, you know, and they were very interested in that. And we said, well, you don't get that unless you vote for the merger with CWA. So it also passed in Canada. So it was good, you know. I mean, it was unifying. It was good. And, you know, so we, I think we felt really good about it. There were some, you know, some bumps along the way, but still, we're Guild's still in CWA, so.
I remember at that point, Larry was pushing the idea, Larry Cohn was pushing the idea that the technological changes were leading to a unified information industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so the journalists would be producing the information. Telecom would be the transmission.
Right.
I don't remember what else was part of it. There were four boxes. Yeah. I don't know how real that was and whether it was just something that helped Larry sell this within CWA
probably.
Or not.
Yeah, but it probably was a little bit real. I mean, yeah. I don't think it was. I mean, if you look at the way the media industry has evolved, it certainly was real, right? So
maybe it was deliberate on CWA's part going after the Newspaper Guild.
Right.
Nabit.
Right. Nabit had come in before.
It was this whole notion,
of
bringing all of these unions together under one umbrella.
Right.
Morty was a big champion of that notion that, that they would all fit together.
Right. All the media unions.
Right.
And now that you're mentioning that, I remember it because I remember I was given the assignment to coordinate this convergence conference.
Oh, yeah. I remember the convergence conference. Yeah.
And the idea was at that point, and now, of course, we've seen this happening, that newspaper journalists were becoming videographers.
Yes.
And the merger of video and
print,
which then was a big issue.
Yeah, it was a huge issue, and because our people didn't do that,
right?
They, you know, we had still photographers, but we didn't have people that did video. They didn't tell stories through video. And the other thing, I think the argument about the convergence and putting everybody under one union who was in this information sector, I think that had a lot of appeal to the Guild people too. I think that was not, that wasn't a bad vision for the Guild. I mean, that was people like that. People like that. You know, they wanted, can we still have our executive board? Can we still do this? Can we still do that? But they liked that whole notion of that. So that did help, I think, steer us to CWA. And I will say this, that the CWA leadership really bent over backwards to make us feel special. No, they really did. They really did. And that was helpful, too. You know, that was helpful, too.
So you mentioned you were running for president at that time. Was that a contested election?
Yes.
So your opponent was
no, nobody.
Merger,
yeah,
or?
Yeah. Everybody supported the merger.
Yeah.
My opponent just opposed me.
Okay.
So can I digress on a little story about that?
Yeah.
This is one of my favorite stories about my career. So Chuck Dale, I was secretary treasurer, but when I ran for secretary treasurer, I didn't run with him. Hmm. I ran on my own, and it was Patrick Hunt from CWA, who was a Guild activist at the time, said to me, "You'll never be able to pull that off, being an independent, and, you know, he's going to kill you. He's going to crush you." He didn't crush me. You know, I won. Well, part of it was that there was this guy from New York running against me who was, not much. So anyway, I won, and I got more votes than he did. And
Than Dale.
And Dale was pretty popular at that point. That sort of shocked me. But one of the things I did was I was the first person. You know, the Guild has one person, one vote for officers, right, that you mail in the ballots. And I actually went out. They had never done this before. I actually went out to locals and campaigned. And nobody had ever done that before. Like, I'd go to workplaces and I'd campaign. And people were impressed by that. They liked that. So I won pretty handily. And, in fact, so my favorite story is that, when I ran for president, so then Dale, he was close to retirement. And as we got toward 1995, I kept saying to him, "Are you going to retire? Because I need to know what I'm going to do." He's like, "Well, I really haven't decided yet." Well, that was not true. He had decided that he was going to retire. He just decided not to tell me. So he didn't run again, and I just announced for president. And he hadn't decided whether he was going to retire or not, but I went into his office and I said, look, you know, this is March. We have the convention in September or whatever it was. I got to announce. I got to do it. I got to get going. I hope you decide to retire because I think you deserve a good retirement. But if you're not going to do that, regardless, I'm going to run. Oh, my God, were they mad. The old guard was so mad about that. So Chuck Perlick, my old ally who is retired, writes a letter to all of his friends in guild leadership positions. And he had considerable network. And the letter starts off like this. The guild is facing a very critical decision because we were voting on CWA. And we are at a very critical time. This is no time for a social experiment. Can you believe that? This is no time for a social experiment.
A woman is
just... Yeah, that's a social experiment. And, well, of course, when that letter went out at the convention, everybody, you know... No, I think he mailed it out. Oh, and there was other stuff in that letter. I saved it. I still have it on my desktop. Because I always go back and look at it every once in a while. I can't believe it. I mean, and this wasn't 1950. This was, you know, 1995, okay? This is no time for a social experiment. And he said, you know, he claimed that I didn't have any experience and that Barry Lipton was the president of the New York Guild. He was running against me. And that, you know, he was very, you know, he had a lot of experience, decades of experience, and he was really good and da-da-da. And that... I spent my whole time under the tutelage, I forget, this is another great line, under the tutelage of the three wise men of the guild, Bill Blatz, Bill McLeman, and Chuck Dale. Like, I was just a, you know, puppet of theirs, I guess. I don't know what that was supposed to be, but it was bad. So, so the women of the guild rebelled. They didn't like that at all. And he ended up retracting the letter.
What percent of the guild do you think was women?
You know, I don't remember, but it was close to half, maybe even a little more. Mm-hmm. Than, I mean, later it was more than half, but mm-hmm. at that point it was close to half. Because remember, we not only represented newsrooms, we represented classified advertising departments. That was all women, right? For the most part, it was all women. And those were the biggest departments in the newspapers at that time. You know, so yeah, we had, I'll never forget, I can still see it. We had a woman get up in a forum we had at the convention, and she said, I want to ask Barry Lipton and Larry Hatfield, they were running against myself and Bernie Lenzer. I want to ask you, are you aware of a letter that Chuck Perlick sent out to guild leaders? That said, among other things, and she started to quote the letter. I mean, she was a journalist, right? She knew how to ask questions. Right. She started, and then she goes, so my question for you is, she quotes the letter extensively, and she goes, my question for you is, do you agree with this letter? And I swear to God, they blew the answer. They said, well, you know, Chuck Perlick is very well respected. And she said, but do you agree with the letter? No, do you disavow the letter? That's the way she put it. She said, do you disavow the letter? And they said, well, you know, Chuck Perlick is very well respected in the guild. And she said, I'm asking you, this is in an open forum, do you disavow the letter? And they said, well, you know, I mean, Chuck Perlick's views deserve to be considered. And she said, so you're not going to disavow the letter. Thank you very much. And she sat down, the place burst into applause. I was like, we're done.
Game, set, match.
It's game, set, match. We're done. So then he issues another letter saying, I'm not a sexist. Honestly, said that in the letter. I am not a sexist. I hired this person, this woman, this woman, this woman, and Linda Foley. But guess the one woman he left out was the one African American woman he had on staff. He forgot. So it just kept getting worse and worse. We called it the Perlick Papers because it just kept getting worse. And then he issued something else later. And then finally, I think finally Larry Hatfield, who was running for secretary, got up on the floor and did disavow the letter at some point. But that was unbelievable. But we were doing the merger at the same time. But there was no daylight between myself and my opponent on the merger. Everybody was in favor of the merger because Chuck Dale was in favor of the merger. So his people, who were the ones running against me, right? They really wanted the merger. So there was no daylight between us. But I am going to share one little thing that I did. this might be boring, but one little thing that I did that I was so happy with myself. And actually, Bill Borman gave me the idea, didn't give me the idea for this part, but he gave me the idea. He said, look, you should be the one presenting the merger agreement. He said, you negotiated it. He said, you tell them you're going to present it. He said, and that gives you, he said, that's what I did. And that was really good advice. And so, but the other thing I did was my colors on my campaign were like teal and purple and gray. So I did a PowerPoint presentation, and guess what colors I used? Teal and purple and gray.
This was to the convention.
To the convention. Yeah. Well, everywhere. Like, we do a convention. Yeah. We do, you know, we would go anywhere people wanted us to go to talk about this.
Yeah.
So I was like, that's my little gift to myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, part of all these mergers that CWA has sort of championed, and frankly, it was one of the selling points, as you identified, was the fact that you could keep your autonomy.
Right.
And so, you know, that autonomy was a big feature. And you gradually integrate those locals in partnership with, you know, the locals that are already CWA locals and other merger partners. But, you know, they continue to maintain that autonomy. The CWA structure, you know, is divided into regions, and each of those regions has some collective bargaining responsibility, but overlaying that then is the sector bargaining responsibility that they retained. So while, you know, they were recognized as partners, they still had, you know, their own identity and really never sort of meshed in that convergence that we thought was ideally gonna take place, which I get. I mean, you know, you've got some pride in your own identity. You know, you see AFA, CWA sometimes, or just AFA. I mean, you want to identify yourself that way. I had a couple of questions about the whole merger experience, but also more pointed about your rise within the union. You talked about going and campaigning in person, which hadn't been done apparently. Mm-hmm. So, did you go to the newsrooms where your opponents were? And
well, first of all, when I first did it, my opponents didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So Pete McLaughlin, who ran against me for Secretary Treasurer, was when I first did it. And he didn't go. He didn't go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he would write letters and stuff and put things in the Guild Reporter that would go out to people, but he wouldn't go and campaign. So the only difficulty with that was I didn't have access to every newsroom. So, mm-hmm. you know, these guys, remember, they were fighting us tooth and nail. So a lot of places they were very, you can't come in here. Mm-hmm. And then I had to figure out some other way to meet people. So if that was the case, then I'd do something at a restaurant, or I'd do something, you know, somewhere else where people gathered and try to, you know, try to meet with them. By the time I ran for president, people saw the success of that.
Mm-hmm.
So my opponents then started doing it too. And the trick was to get somebody to show you around the newsroom. So and the class around, not just the newsroom, mm-hmm. but the whole place, right? The whole Guild unit. And so a lot depended on who your friends were there, and they would take you around and introduce you. And then, and you had to be a little careful because, you know, these employers were not, most of them were not our friends, mm-hmm. and they didn't like people to be interrupted. And it made them really nervous to see a, you know, high Guild official come in and start to talk to people. So, but it was really fun. And what it did was it really, the people in the locals that I visited, and I visited some of the larger ones. Like, I did go to the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
I did go to the Washington Post. But the smaller papers were the place where people were most impressed with that.
Yeah.
Because no one ever came to see them, right? So when I went to, one of my best, this wasn't a smaller paper, but one of my best visits was at the Plain Dealer, actually. Mm-hmm. It was a great visit because I knew so many people there. And they were like so, you know, nice to me. And, mm-hmm. you know, and that was not at that point a real hostile environment. So, but these smaller papers like the Manchester Union Leader in Manchester, New mm-hmm. Hampshire, I mean, that was a blast because I would go in and, you know, and there'd be, you know, there weren't that many people there, and they would come over and they would say, oh, you know, and then they'd ask me all kinds of questions about the union. It was really great. And, you know, you had to be judicious about,
right.
you know, what you did. And the other thing was, it was really expensive.
Yeah.
Like, I spent a lot of my own money doing that, because now some people, my friends who were reps, mm-hmm. staff reps, had points. So my friends would give me points. and that helped a lot, especially I remember in Canada, I went from Toronto to the CBC in Vancouver, and my friend gave me points to take that flight. Otherwise, that would have cost me, you know, over $1,000 to make that flight, right?
Points mean frequent flyer miles.
Frequent flyer miles, yeah. Frequent flyer points, right. And a lot of times I'd stay at people's houses.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'd stay in a hotel, but I'd stay at people's houses. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people considered that like a contribution to me. Like, they said, I'll pay for your hotel room.
Yeah.
I had someone pay for my hotel room in Buffalo.
Yeah.
I'll pay for your hotel room. And so, you know, people really like that.
So when you were running for president, did the merger agreement then give you sort of an extra vehicle to get around and talk with people?
Yeah, although people on the floor were not that interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
The leadership was interested in it. The people on the floor weren't interested in it. I mean, they were interested in, when are we going to get our mileage rate increased? You know, I mean, stuff like that. Typical, like, now. I do it now. Like, when are you going to put a speed camera on my road? You know, it was like that kind of thing. So they weren't that interested in it. Mm-hmm. To the extent that they were, it was concerns about identity, right? So they were like, well, you know, are we going to get swallowed up? You know, what's going to happen? There were questions like that.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, that wasn't so much on their radar as it was the leadership.
Yeah.
So sometime, I can't remember if we did, I guess we did do a couple of local things. What I would do too is I was being sent, because I was Secretary of Treasury, being sent by the Guild and the CWA all around the country. So every time I'd go somewhere, like if there was a meeting in
mm-hmm.
Cleveland,
right.
I would then go to the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and then I'd get in my car and I'd drive to the Toledo Blade, and then I'd drive to Akron, and yeah, you know, I just use it as a jumping off point mm-hmm. to go meet people. So I did a lot of that save money, because it was expensive.
So the merger, I mean, what we've talked about so far sounds like smooth sailing, but obviously there's rough spots. And
they came after.
Yeah. So why don't you talk about a few of those?
Okay. So, So, I mean, like anything like this, so it was a big deal. Putting that together was a big deal, right? An agreement like that. Lots of people's lives affected putting that together. So, there were things that there are two sources of tension. One, things that we didn't address that we should have. And two, this whole tension among, you know, like the question you asked Jeff about whether the Guild locals integrated with the CWA locals. So there was tension on both sides of that, right? That continued. So, you know, I would have locals call me and say, you know, the CWA wants us to do this. We're different. We're not the CWA. Well, yeah, you are the CWA, but you know, so there was a lot of that. And then there were things that we just didn't address. Like, for example, this is the best example. And it caused me a lot of grief sometimes. So we knew about the Members Relief Fund, which mm-hmm. was very attractive, right? Mm-hmm. Because part of our problem was that we got eaten alive by strike benefits. And when we paid strike benefits, we were so small that it triggered a huge dues increase when our defense fund fell below a certain amount. So having access to the Member Relief Fund was huge. Huge.
Remind us what the Members Relief Fund
The
is.
Members Relief Fund is a fund that CWA has that basically pays people a portion of their salary when they're on strike. Critically important, because people can't go without a paycheck. The other thing that CWA did that was very good was, because the other problem with being on strike is you lose your health benefits after a certain point. So CWA had this other fund called the Defense Fund. You all know this, right? The Defense Fund that paid strike-related expenses and helped out with medical coverage for strikers. Well, the Guild, when we merged, I don't think we really understood all of that. So we never addressed the defense fund part of it. And then we also had Canadian members. The Canadian healthcare system, as you know, is much different. Well, they wanted a piece of that as well. So we had this tension over, you know, over that issue. And we finally, I think, worked it out. But it was very contentious. I mean, the Canadians were really pissed off because they were on strike and they didn't get the health care benefits. And, you know, we pay, you know. So we ended up assessing the members an additional amount so that they could participate in that defense fund part. Because we never addressed that in the merger agreement. Yeah. So that's a good example of something that we didn't think about dealing with when we went in.
So I think what you're saying is initially guild members' dues did not include an assessment to contribute to these funds. Therefore, you couldn't access that? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, we could access, and maybe Jeff remembers better than I do, we could access the member relief fund,
right.
And I don't remember why we could do that. I guess because a portion of our dues went in there.
Yeah, so that was built into the dues, the members relief fund, but,
right.
But the defense fund was,
we 50, forgot about it.
Was 50 cents per member,
right.
And that just
we
was,
forgot about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't come in, and so then when... Then when people went on strike and they were like, well, we didn't get these, you know,
right.
We had to fix that. And that was a tough one.
And the defense fund is the big
no.
fund, right?
No.
Members relief is the big fund.
And that's where the members relief fund came in. The
right.
defense fund just wasn't capable of handling any major strikes.
Right.
And so we created this members relief fund and then left sort of the ancillary benefits to
in
the defense fund. And, you know, the irony is, The defense fund doesn't actually pay a health care premium. They will pay some of your medical expenses that haven't been met.
Right.
And, you know, well, in Canada, there weren't any
there
medical
weren't any,
expenses
yeah.
to meet.
But, that,
you know,
and,
I get
and
the
we
tension.
Worked out a deal where they did get, like, a stipend
yeah,
to offset
help.
The premiums.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, because those people always got what they wanted. But
they were a big unit.
Big unit
yeah.
and smart leadership.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you know, Arnold Amber was an interesting person. Very, very good friend of mine, but he was very smart.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he knew, you know, like. But anyway, so yeah, they. So that was one area where we had a lot of tension, and then this whole, you know, the political thing we knew was going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
We dealt with that. We spent a lot of time talking about that in the merger agreement and what.
The political.
Yeah. So CWA is a very politically active union, and TNG was not. So, you know, this whole thing about we have to be neutral, we can't. By the way, they're still dealing with that.
Yeah.
We, you know, we have to be, not CWA even.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be neutral, we can't take positions, we can't endorse candidates, we can't, you know.
Right.
So we got from Morty and Larry that CWA endorsed presidents, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was voted on at the convention. So we actually wrote into the merger agreement that TNG vice president, no, it was voted by the executive board. TNG
mm-hmm.
vice president could abstain on behalf of TNG members in the vote. But that wasn't good enough for the people in the guild. So hence you had, it was Peter Sake, who's a lovely person, Reuters reporter.
Mm-hmm.
You had Peter Sake get up at every convention and say, on behalf of the journalists, I, you know, so what? I mean,
yeah.
fine.
Yeah.
But some CWA members would get really upset with that. Because they're like, what's wrong with you? You know, don't you support, you know, John Kerry or, you know, pick
yeah.
one, right? So, and that was a little bit of a, you know, that was difficult. And then the other difficult part was the Canadians got greedy and wanted somebody on the CWA executive board, which we had never really contemplated. But that was really dicey. And that was a real, we ended up working that out. But that was, and now they do have somebody on there.
Yeah.
And that was really difficult. But we did that on purpose. We did not put a Canadian on the CWA executive board. We did that on purpose. We knew that.
Mm-hmm.
But then they came back and said, well, we deserve somebody after the fact. And we worked it out because at one point, Larry Cohen had said to the Canadian director, who was Arnold Amber, we could give you a seat, a non-voting seat on the executive board. I don't think people will care about that. And Arnold said, no, I have to have a vote. Well, when some of Arnold's people found out that he had been offered that and turned it down, they weren't happy.
Mm-hmm.
So they urged him to do that. And that's kind of where it ended up. And then eventually they... Because the executive board expanded, and they eventually got a seat on the executive board. So it worked out. That part worked out.
Linda, you were president from 95 through 2008. Mm-hmm. What were some of the biggest challenges you faced as Guild President, CWA Vice President?
Well, the biggest challenge I faced was the shrinking of the newspaper industry and the news business, the consolidation and then shrinking. You know, we were looking at job losses. You know, now they're even more catastrophic. I didn't think they could get more catastrophic, but now they're even more catastrophic. But, you know, we were looking at job losses in some cases, like a third of the workforce would be, you know, laid off or bought out. And our membership, you know, was going down. And it was, so that was by far and away the biggest problem we had. And it impacted our bargaining power. We couldn't negotiate contracts, you know, in the way that we used to. On a smaller scale, the Detroit newspaper strike started when I was secretary treasurer.
What year?
93 or 94. And continued for like a decade after that. That was really tough because the people who are, I mean, when people go on strike and they don't have 100% solidarity or near 100% solidarity, you're always going to get a division between the people who are in and the people who are out. So the people who are out, look at the people who are in, especially the longer this goes on, the more of a problem it becomes. And they say, well, wait a minute, I'm having a lot of trouble here. My life is a mess and they're still working. Why don't I just go back and work, right? They're doing it. Why don't I do it? Very hard to keep that line tight. And then in Detroit, and then the other thing that happens with the hardcore believers and the people who really are prosecuting the strike is they become more and more militant. So we were trying to get them to make an unconditional offer to go back to work because there were unfair labor practice charges, and they wouldn't do it. I mean, this was like 5 years after the strike, right? They wouldn't do it. And, you know, and it was a big fight. It was, you know, and people were really nasty about it. I mean, just really nasty. I mean, I remember we used to give an award called the Haywood Bruin Award, named after the founding president of the Guild. And it's a pretty prestigious journalism award. And so we had a panel of journalists judge it. And so I picked a woman named Susan Watson, who had been quite a popular columnist in Detroit and then became a very, very activist in the strike. Excuse me. And she never actually went back to work at the papers, but I picked her to be a judge, and she used her opportunity as a judge to rail against me and the Guild and how we had abandoned them. It was pretty bad. This was at our awards. And it was like, you know, so there were a lot of hard feelings with that. That was really tough because a lot of people's lives were really upended and people really got hurt. And it was a rough, rough strike. I mean, there was a lot of violence in the strike. You know, there was, you know, people got hurt. It was a rough strike and it went on for a long time.
And did that have an impact on your power in other units?
Yes, totally. Well, because people said, well, look, you know, the guild can't do anything. Look what's happening in Detroit. You know, you can't. Detroit of all places. We'd always hear that. Detroit of all places. You know, you can't get anything done. You know what? You know, we don't want that here. Why do we want that here? And organizing it really hurt us.
What were some of the biggest achievements or accomplishments of your tenure?
The CWA merger. Because I feel like the CWA merger saved the union. There would be no News Guild today. It's called the News Guild now, but it would be no News Guild today had we not merged with CWA. That is clear. And I don't think it would have lasted, you know, 5 years after that ITU thing fell apart if we hadn't merged with CWA, really. So putting together a merger that allowed the Guild to maintain its own identity and to be able to still appeal to workers in the industry, I consider that really important. I consider the Canadian part of that agreement really important because we had such a problem with our Canadian members threatening to leave our union because they didn't have enough autonomy, enough say-so over their own, works and stuff. And then, I mean, their own members and, you know, they were always beholden to Washington. And to be able to through the merger agreement and then going forward, to be able to to put in place an organization, you know, a union that really could represent them. I think now they may even be the strong, I mean, things are not terrific, but they may be the strongest media union in Canada now.
And the backbone is the CBC, is that correct?
Yeah, that's a big one. I mean, that was a whole thing. I wish I could take credit for the CBC, but I can't. I mean, that was Arnold and Lise Leroux and some other people that made that happen. But no, there was a consolidation vote at the CBC, and all of the units ended up being part of the Canadian Media Guild. And so the union went from like 150 members to like 3,000 members, or 2,000 members, whatever it was.
Over what period?
Like overnight almost.
And what night was it? What year?
When was that? It was in the early 2000s. Yeah. No, it was right around the time of the merger. So it might have been, it was in the late 1990s, because I remember going with Bill McLeaman to a meeting of the newly formed Canadian Media Guild with all these new members in it. And I said to him, Bill, you know, CWA merger is really important. This is almost as important right here. Anyway, so that was a big one. And then my other thing that I love that I did when I didn't have too many of these victories, but we saved a newspaper in Hawaii, and that was a lot of fun. That was really good. Remember, we had that guy, you worked with us, Debbie, on that. We had that guy, Todd Miller, who was an antitrust attorney, and they tried to dissolve the joint operating agreement and close this Honolulu Star Bulletin, and we saved it. Right. We saved it. To me, that was like, you know, how many times, you know, 100 people had their job saved because we went to bat for that. You know, we worked on that. And again, I go back to the CWA. The Guild as itself could never have afforded. I mean, Todd Miller was very reasonable as an antitrust attorney, but we could never have afforded to do that on our own, ever. And I remember going to Morty and saying, you know, this is a real, you know, this is going to be really expensive. He goes, is it going to work? I said, I can't guarantee it's going to work, but I think we have a shot. He goes, okay, we'll do it. You know, and I mean, we could never have done that on our own, ever.
Well, and I would add to that, that had feedback throughout the union, because mm-hmm. that was the first that I am aware that we got involved in antitrust in front of the Department of Justice.
It's a second, actually, but the first one wasn't successful. It was before your time with me.
When was that?
San Antonio. We did something in San Antonio and came really close to keeping the San Antonio Light afloat, but it didn't work. I mean, the court ruled against us. But that was the first time. That definitely was the first and maybe the only time that it worked.
And in the newspaper.
In the newspaper,
we learned a lot throughout the union about that.
Yeah.
And that brings me to the next question. You were also very involved in proceedings at the FCC.
Yep.
Because this was a period in which there was a lot of pressure to weaken the media ownership rules, and particularly the ban on newspaper broadcast cross ownership.
Yes.
And so I want you to talk about why you did that, and if now seeing where the newspaper industry has gone, if you think that was the right decision.
Let me take the first part of that, for the last part of that first. I don't think you can do that. Like, if I'm looking at it objectively, I'd say no, it probably wasn't. We probably should have let them merge, right? But you can't say that, because it was a different time, and it was a different market. So, you know, I can't second guess that. But in terms of, keeping, I mean, the whole thing was about independent journalism. That's why I cared about it so much, was independent journalism. And I wanted to make sure that we preserved independent journalism. And to have independent journalism, you have to have news organizations. Sounds silly saying it now, though, because journalism is such a disarray. But you have to have news organizations that, have the wherewithal to support professional journalism with wages, with backup and with, you know, I mean, there's a whole lot that goes into that. So combining these papers took away from that. I mean, you know, combining ownership took away from that and removed, and sacrificed robust professional journalism for expediency. And that, you know, that was good for the investors, but it was terrible for journalism. So that's one of the big reasons I got involved in it. And I think the other the other aspect of it was that these companies were just getting too big, you know. And they were so the nice thing about the newspaper industry when we think of it nostalgically, right, is that it was local companies that were good companies, good places to work, made a lot of money, right? Good places to work, local companies, serving the local people in a community. And as the consolidation happened, you got further and further away from that. So you got to the point where you didn't, I mean, now, you know, you don't have a newsroom, you know, well, you might have a newsroom, but you're not even printing the paper in the same city. I mean, if you're printing the paper at all, you know, and they consolidated, it allowed them to consolidate, you know, different departments, and it allowed them to consolidate the newsroom so that you really move further and further away from that.
Did it also mean that you, through the guild and through you, formed coalitions with groups that otherwise...
Oh, yeah.
Talk about that.
So there was a whole movement around this. And I used to attend, even when I was not in leadership and I was a staffer, I would attend these meetings on media concentration. And, you know, a lot of people would show up and they would be like, for lack of a better term, like old hippies, right? Because they would show up and they would be like, I've got my newspaper. It'd be one guy putting out a newspaper, right? I got my newspaper. I went and at one of those meetings, but there were some good, you know, there were some good things going on, but at one of those meetings, and this was early on, this was in the early 90s, that guy, Bob, McChesney. Bob McChesney was there, and he was like a rock star.
From University of Illinois.
And people were like, oh, McChesney, he's great on this issue. So he and I started to talk, and then we formed this, relationship. And so he and then this other guy, John Nichols, who was from Wisconsin, founded an organization called Free Press. I still am not clear where they got all their money, but Free Press, where they would, they were fighting for, you know, independence and, you know, fighting against media consolidation, and they got to be quite big. Mm-hmm. And so all of these, so, you know, this was a time when we were, I'm trying to think, it was either Reagan or Bush was president. I mean, the country was pretty far to the right, and there was and so these folks were all like, you know, lefties, right? So they were all, so it became kind of like this stand-in for this new movement of, you know, left-leaning people. I'm not saying we led to the election of Barack Obama or anything like that, but there were a lot of people. I mean, I met people like Al Franken and Jesse Jackson and Bernie Sanders. They were all at these conferences, you know, speaking and talking about media concentration, because they recognized, and we can see it now, right, that, you know, if you didn't pay attention to this, it was detrimental to democracy. And that, so all of these political leaders were there for that reason. You know, it really took, I mean, Ralph Nader showed up at one point, although no one wanted to talk to him, but he showed up at one point, they're like, Ralph Nader's here. But they would get like 2,000 people at these conferences. I mean, he went, right? They would get all these people at these conferences. And these were people who were, you know, this was a big issue for them. I think they did see that the technology was such, not just for news, but for content in general, because we had a lot of music people there. So they, you know, they saw that this was, you know, a bad trend that was coming, and they were right. So, yeah, it allowed me to form a lot of coalitions with different people. And I got to meet Phil Donahue. Yeah, Cleveland guy, who's still alive, by the way. Yeah.
So you were president until 2008.
Yes.
I want to move on to after that, but before okay. I do, anything else you want to add, or Jeff, you yeah. want to ask? Anything okay. else you want to add about your tenure, or should we move on to after that?
No. No. It was, I loved it. I loved doing it. I loved being in CWA. I met so many good people in CWA. I met a lot of good people in the Newspaper Guild, too. Very interesting people. I loved it. I thought it was really...
What was it like to be one of the few women on the executive board?
Oh, on the CWA executive board?
Mm-hmm.
I never felt... I mean, yeah, you look around and say, well, we could use more women. But remember, Barbara Easterling was secretary treasurer. And when I first started to interact with CWA, that was a big deal. I think there were I think it was Barbara Eschling. We go to these secretary treasurer conferences. Mm-hmm. It was Barbara Eschling, myself, and a woman from the brewery workers,
right.
And Sharon from AFA. There were four of us out of all the unions in the AFL-CIO who were women secretary treasurers. So Barbara Eschling being a secretary treasurer of the CWA was a big deal. So I always felt like CWA did pretty well in that area. Not perfect, right? And there were individuals who didn't do so well. But, I mean, as an institution, I felt like, as an organization, I felt like CWA did, I think they did better. We always had a lot of women on our executive board in the Guild, but I think that CWA did as well or better than the Guild on that score. So I never felt that I was not heard or that I was in a minority or that I was somehow looked down upon when I was on the CWA executive board. I never felt that.
Did you see a role for yourself as fighting for more women and more roles for women within the labor movement?
Yes, but I was pretty busy doing other things. So, you know, I say yes, but remember, I also, and this was during my tenure as Guild president, I also established the Burger Marx Foundation with Louise Walsh, Annie Ben Herrera, and Kitty Petticord. And that was a little foundation where we funded women to do leadership training, and we funded women organizers. So the Burger Marx, that's a whole other part of my life that I could talk about for a long time. But that I think that was the most important work I did there in terms of women, other than being a role model, which I think I was.
Talk a little bit more about Burger Marx, because I think this is really an interesting story, the origins of it.
So we had a woman rep in the Guild before my time, really. Her name was Edna Berger. She was a legend. She, like a lot of people, she reminded me a lot of Dina Beaumont, actually, but like a lot of women who were in the labor movement at that time. I mean, she was very, I hate to say masculine, but she was very, aggressive, and it had to be, right? Because it was their world. And so she was very successful as a rep and beloved. She retired. She retired like my first convention that I attended. She was retiring. So she retired, but then she started to slip. And her husband was a Tin Pan Alley musician. And he had a whole song catalog. He was older than she was, but he had a whole song catalog called, and one of his most venerable song was the song All of Me, the jazz, All of Me, Why Not Take All of Me? He was, he would always remind you of that. So when Edna passed away, Louise Walsh, who had been active in the Guild and was then at the George Meany Center for Labor Studies, came to me and said, I was really good friends with Edna. I really want to, she was from the Guild. I really want to honor her. Would you be open to setting up a scholarship fund for her? I said, yes. So we set up a scholarship fund, and we figured out people, locals could contribute, and we'll send somebody to the George Meany Center, and they can take training. Women can take training. And then when Gerald found out about it, and this time he was well into his 90s, his accountant called me up and said, Mr. Marx would like to meet with you about the scholarship fund. He said, and I'm going to tell you, it'll really be worth your while to do that. I said, okay. I would have done it anyway, right? So I went up to New York, had a delightful time with him. He was a delightful person. I had a delightful time with him. He was like 96. And then the accountant called me after that visit and said, Mr. Marx really, really liked you. He did make a contribution to the fund that was several thousand dollars. And he said, I just want to tell you that Mr. Marx said, if you change the name of the scholarship fund from the Edna Berger Scholarship Fund to the Edna Berger Gerald Marx Scholarship Fund, you'll be in for a lot of money when he passes away. I said, done. So we ended up getting, we thought we were going to get thousands of dollars. We ended up getting millions of dollars. I don't mean like $10 million, but it was like $6 million in the end altogether. And so we put together this board, and we really did some neat stuff. Like we would give an award every year called the Edna Award, and it was like a mini, I used to think of it as a mini MacArthur grant. So women under 35, and we were adamant about that. Well, I'm 36, but I just turned 36. Sorry, you have to be under 35. You have to be 35 by the end of the year. Like if you're 35 on December 31, you get to participate. Otherwise, sorry, if you turn 35 on December 30th, or if you turn 36, you're not eligible. So we had under 35 and under, And Yvette was a big part of this. And this is where Yvette and I got close doing this, because we had this group of women that were on this board. It was a fabulous board. And we put out a, people would apply for the award, and we ended up giving like runners up, and we picked 10 finalists. And then we had a panel of women outside of the Burger Marks Foundation that included like Liz Schuler and Terry O'Neill from Now, and Mary K. Henry, and, you know, these women leaders, and they actually picked the winners. And then we had a winner and two runners up. And then we brought everybody for the awards ceremony who were the top 10 finalists. Like, the board picked the top 10 finalists. We brought them all, paid for their hotel room, took them to dinner that night, and had a big thing at the press club. And it got to be like a really great event. We did that for about 5 years, I think. 5 years, I think we did it. And it was really a great thing. And there are people who got the award. One woman, when we...
What would you get the award for?
For just being a leader in social justice movement.
Not necessarily the labor movement.
No, allies. But then later, we did institute another award that was just for union organizers. But it was less.
And you got the money.
We had the money.
That was what the award was, money?
Yeah, it's money. It was just like a MacArthur grant. We just gave you the money and said,
go do good things.
Go do good things. And we had a ceremony. And,
Does it still exist?
No. So I'm also kind of proud of this. So toward the end of our tenure, Carolyn Jacobson died. She was on our board. She unfortunately died of cancer. It was very sad. And Louise, who was the chair and I was the president, she and I talked, and she said, Carolyn, maybe it was before Carolyn died, but we knew she was going to die. She was very sick. Carolyn's in bad shape. And Kitty Petticord is moving to the West Coast. Do we really want to keep doing this? It's getting to be a struggle for us. So we would hate for it to just fade away. So we came up with the idea that we would go to some organizations. We picked organizations that we had worked with and said, submit an RFP and we'll give you whatever's left. And whatever's left ended up being like $2 million. So we'll give you whatever's left, because we're going to go out of business. But you give us a plan that you're going to, work with women and develop women leaders, and we'll look at it. And whoever does the best job will, So it was a joint project. We gave it to a joint project between the Kalmanovitz Institute at Georgetown and Marilyn Snyderman's program at Rutgers. And so now it's called Will Empower.
Oh, that's where
that comes from. So we gave them the money. They laid out a whole plan. We gave them the money, and they're still doing it. And I said to Louise after that, I said, I'm really proud of us. I mean, we could have just like gone off, and had dinners. I said, but, we decided we weren't going to do that, that we were going to really. So that was a really fun thing to do. That was the best thing I did for women, I think.
That sounds fabulous.
It was fun.
Do you still get royalties from All of Me?
No. So what happened was we were getting royalties from All of Me, but we were not set up to really deal with that. So people would call all the time and say, I want to use it in a cartoon. Can I use it? And we'd have to give them. So what we actually did was, because at some point those copyrights run out. So we hired a lawyer, music industry lawyer. I wish I could remember her name. She was full of bling. Like, she'd come and she'd have these diamond purses, and Louise would go, I love her. What was her name? I can't remember. Anyway, so we hired her, and she said, look, you're going to have to, the rights are going to run out. See if you can sell the song catalog, because you have to sell the whole, catalog, right? See if you can sell the song catalog and see what you can get for it. Let's just try it. So she went and set it up, and we got bids, and Warner Music bought it. And I think we got, for the whole song catalog, I think we got $2 or $3 million for that. So we were like, okay, we'll take that, right? And then we just, because the administration of it was getting to be really boring. So anyway, it was fun. Yeah, it was really fun. And so when I'd go into a bar, or like when I was with the International Federation of Journalists, and I was like in Australia or something, I'd say, watch this. So I'd go up to the bar and say, can you play All of Me? And then they would play All of Me, and then I would tell them the story.
Cha-ching.
Cha-ching. That's what I'd say. Cha-ching.
Oh, how fun. Okay, let's move on to the very end.
Okay.
Which is that you were elected to the Maryland State Legislature, and
yes,
you wanted to talk about that, and particularly what your leadership in TN, in the Newspaper Guild and in CWA contributed to you being able to be.
Well, for one thing, you know, let's just start here. It exposed me to politics, right? Because when that was a CWA part of it, because in the Guild, we really weren't that exposed to politics. A little bit, but not, you know. So being exposed to politics was, you know, interesting and something that, you know, it's easy to see the nexus between politics and unions, right? So I'm a hell of a door knocker, by the way, because, right? I spent my career doing that, right? So, and I love it because it's what I was, you know, what I grew up doing. So, so being exposed to politics. And then I think the other part of it is that it was, you know, it was, so briefly, my career in local politics was, I kicked around for a while. I didn't know what to do. And I decided I was going to get involved in, I live in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is, you know, a good place to be involved in politics. People are very engaged here. So I said, you know, I should get involved in local politics. So I ran for the Central Committee, the Democratic Central Committee of Montgomery County. And that's an elected position. And I actually was unopposed because they elect a man and a woman, right? So I was unopposed. And so I got on the Central Committee. And then the Central Committee kind of blew up over finances. And so they came to me and said, you know, you have all this union background. We think you'd be, you have like real experience with this stuff. We think, would you consider being chair? I don't know. So my friend Lily Chi, who's now a delegate with me here in this district, I said, Lily, what do you think? Should I do it? She goes, let me just put it this way. It can't be any worse. I said, okay. You can't do worse. I said, okay. Okay, you're right. I mean, you know. So I took that on. And then COVID hit. And but bottom line was we turned the Central Committee around. I mean, it's Montgomery County. It's not hard to raise money here. Okay? Not hard to raise money here for Democrats. Not hard. So we turned it around. Our coffers were full. We were the first ones in the Maryland politics to really do Zoom meetings for like town halls and stuff. And our elected leaders loved it because we set it all up. So I became pretty well known among the elected leaders. And then in 2021, at the end of 2021, Kathleen Dumais, who was a delegate from this district, who's a lawyer, got appointed judge. And that left a vacancy. So I was chair of the Central Committee. Central Committee makes the appointment. I did recuse myself, but I got appointed to fill this vacancy. So that was 2022 session. And then at the end of that, I had to stand for election because then the elections were being held in 2022. So I had to run for election. And then that was 2020. That was like last year. And it was weird because they kept postponing the primary because of there was a court case over redistricting and it was, but anyway, and so I got elected, you know, delegate and.
What's your district number?
15, it's district 15. So in Maryland, there are three delegates for every district, more or less. And then there's one senator. Mm-hmm. So I'm one of three delegates for district 15.
And you were telling us in the beginning, some of the other things
yeah.
that you learned from being a yeah. CWA leader.
So I mentioned door knocking, you know, the organizing part is important, and also bringing people together. So being able to compromise. I mean, I love my colleagues in Annapolis for the most part, but there's some that are just, they don't get it. They don't understand how you bring people together and compromise. How do you get to, you know, an agreement on something? And legislation is that, right? It's not my way or the highway. You have to compromise. Even if you don't have, like, Republican opposition, in my case, there's still people have their interests, and you have to figure out how do we address the interests without losing the core part of what we want. And that's very much like union bargaining, so or contract bargaining. So learning that was really important skill for me, and also realizing that there's always another day. Like you can always live to fight another day, right? So you don't have to have all this pressure. And it's even less so what I'm in now. I mean, it was more, the stakes were higher in the union movement, but even in Detroit, I mean, we lived to fight another day, and that was a horrible situation. And that was a, you know, that was a tough one, that strike. And there's no way we won that strike, but we did live to fight another day. And so there's always tomorrow. And that is very relaxing when you think about it in this kind of job, right? So there's that. And then I think the other part was after being president of the News Guild and being in CWA and being a vice president and, you know, working on the media concentration stuff, you know, on the national stage, I came into this with a lot of confidence. And understanding that even if I didn't get there, you know, again, you know, there's something else. It's not like that's not the end of the world. So
before we went on tape, you used two other phrases, risk taking and courage.
Right. So it did. I mean, before I got in the union movement, I was pretty risk averse. Yeah, I was. We grew up pretty comfortably and I was pretty risk averse. My parents were very cautious, you know, oh, don't do that. And what the union movement taught me was to take risks. And I don't mean physical danger, but although there was some of that, but you know, you can take risks and go out on a limb for what you think is important. It doesn't mean you're going to win all the time, but you'll never lose doing that. You'll never lose. As long as you're true to that, you'll never lose. You might not win, but you'll never lose. So being able to take risks, you know, being in Annapolis and voting on bills is nothing compared to being on the picket line in Detroit and having, you know, people run at you with scab vans. I mean, you know, it's much, that's a physical, you know, thing, but, or having to negotiate a contract or having to, you know, rolling the dice and seeing if you can save the Honolulu Star Bulletin, right? That the stakes there were so much higher even than they are here, because I'm one of 400 and some people, right? So I don't, you know, what I do is not unimportant. It is important, but it's not, you know, my effect can only be so much. And that's part of the union movement too, which is, you know, we're all together, right? This is about community.
And courage? Or if you just already
I think that's part of it. You know, not being risk averse, I think takes some courage, and it took me a while to get up the courage. It's not like I don't sometimes at night say, what am I doing? Like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? But I'm able to calm myself down because I'm able to say, well, yeah, but this wasn't as hard as, you know, when we were bargaining in Seattle and we were trying to get an agreement to go back to work and we misstated what the agreement said. You know, I mean, that's, you know, that was a whole different thing. Or this isn't, the stakes aren't as high as, you know, taking the Guild and merging it with CWA, right? So. So it does give you a little bit of courage. I think it's just kind of like, you know, at this stage, there's not a lot that could really like be, there's nothing that I can see in my professional career as a legislator that would be catastrophic.
You know, when you said that you had been risk averse and now we've gone through this interview and listened to all of the risks that you took, it's interesting to hear you characterize yourself as having once been risk averse because you took quite a number of jumps.
I did, I guess. I did. Yeah, I did.
Jeff, any more questions?
No. Okay, good.
And Linda, anything that you'd like to add at the very end?
No, I talked enough. Yeah, I talked enough.
Well, I think that your warmth and your personality and your enjoyment of people definitely comes out through all the stories. And if you were talking to a younger person getting involved in the Guild, in this environment where being in journalism is such a tough time right now,
what would I tell them?
Yeah.
I still think, even though it's a really tough time, I think it's incredibly important. It's incredibly important work. And most people who go into it feel that way, I think, because they don't go into it to get rich, right? So so it's incredibly important work, and they need to stick with it because of that. I don't know what form it's going to take in the future and whether, you know, I hope the future's bright. I can't even say that, but I do think that it's important to stick with it because it is important. And I will say this. The unionization of the of journalism is incredibly important, and You have to be able to stand up for yourself first before you stand up for the afflicted, right? So if you're supposed to be, you know, you're supposed to comfort the afflicted and take on the powers that be. Yeah.
And afflict the comfortable.
And afflict the comfortable. Thank you. Yeah. You're supposed to, and you can't really do that if you're not standing up for yourself. So you got to stand up for yourself first. And the best way to do that always is a union, because you can never do it on your own. These, you know, these companies are big. And even if they weren't big, you couldn't do it on your own. You need your coworkers to be there with you. You know, you need to be able to be, you know, together. And so, so I would add that, you know, you have to be able to stand up for yourself first, and you have to be, you know, work with your colleagues to, you know, to be in the union and to make sure that you are standing up for yourselves, because that's the only way you're going to maintain any standards. There's no pushback other than that. There's no pushback other than that. You know, it is a tough time for it, but for journalism. But I think it probably will survive. It just might not look like what it looks like now.